Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm really thrilled to be with all of you today. I missed last week because of Thanksgiving, but I have a lot to share with you about Thanksgiving because it was another wonderful year of feeding those in need. And my guest is going to be Mark Wynn, who is the author of a new book called Foodtown USA. And he has so much to share with us, so I'm really excited that he'll be with us. And, of course, I have my recipe I want to share with you and some things that are going on in and around the city that I want to share. So welcome, and make yourself comfortable, and here we go. So lots of things are coming up. Of course, it's the holidays, and December 6th is a New York City youth climate strike taking place at City Hall in New York City from 12 to 3. If you're up for that, next Wednesday, December 11th, I will be moderating a panel at the Brooklyn Public Library called The Green New Meal. It's the Food Climate Connection, and that is going to be a wonderful evening. We have a panel with Nancy Romer, who is a climate activist, and she was one of the founders of the Brooklyn Food Coalition, and Onika Abraham from Farm School in New York City. She's the director there. And we will be having a great discussion and talk and Q&A, and so come on down. We'd love to have you there from 7 to 8:30 next Wednesday. This past Thursday was, as you know, Thanksgiving, and the 2 days before that, for the past 25 years, I've been gathering community together to feed people who are in need in partnership with the River Fund Food Pantry. And this year we had a situation that we have never experienced before, where the community where we've been doing this for the past 20 years has changed and has started to go through gentrification, and the Jamaica Hospital, which was dilapidated and closed for many years, has been converted into condos, and they no longer wanted to attract people in the park across the street from these new condos. And so the River Fund did not get a permit to be in the park, and so we could not feed the people there, and so we panicked. We didn't know if we were going to be canceling up until the very last minute. And then we got permission to, we got a permit to do it at the Pink Houses, which are projects in eastern New York. And, you know, I didn't know where it was. I looked it up, and, of course, you know, it said it was projects. It was a dangerous area. The first homicide of 2019 happened there. And I'm thinking, oh, great, you know, this is where we're going. But, you know, our spirit is so good when everybody's together and there's so much activity and everyone's so positive. I really wasn't concerned. And we went down and just had a gorgeous day. You know, for 4 days, cooking happens in my house. We do everything. I even cook turkeys, which, you know, everybody who eats turkey comes in and says the house smells great. And to me, it doesn't smell so great. But nevertheless, I cook the turkeys that are donated. The majority of the foods that we're cooking are donated. We get a donation for the refrigerated truck that sits out in my driveway for the 4 days to store all the food. And it's a huge, major happening. And this was our 25th year, and we were supposed to do Christmas, which was going to be 3 weeks later, and we just got notice that, they didn't get the permit, but they feel like they need to go to that same community. Those people there really need them, and they skipped Thanksgiving week so that we could go to the Pink Houses. So they're going to return to that area but just not serve any hot food. And so we're going to be taking this holiday off. I know myself, I will jump in and help Community Solidarity or some other organization, but I am not going to be organizing my big cooking event this Christmas, which, you know, is sad, and at the same time, I feel like, you know, it's just going to give me a little bit of a rest, which I'm feeling like I need. So I'm excited about that. I hope everybody who's on with us right now had a wonderful Thanksgiving, surrounded by family and friends. You know, it never ceases me to stop and take time to really be thankful and to just count my blessings and to bring in the real meaning of Thanksgiving and, you know, what this holiday is about, and to pay honor to the indigenous people who were in this land before us, and to just recognize the true meaning of Thanksgiving and what it's about and how we got here, and it's not all that it was painted to be. So that being said, I also want to share with you some take action things that you can participate in. In New York, we have been fighting the Williams Pipeline for years, it feels like. Probably has been years, certainly for months, and twice it was defeated, and now they're coming back for a third time. They just don't want to take no for an answer. But the Williams Pipeline was going to go from New Jersey through Staten Island and across New York Harbor. And if it leaked, which most pipelines do leak, it would have been devastating to the health of our water, to the use of the water, to the beaches, to the aquaculture. Just would have been horrible. And then, of course, tourism, you know, everybody that hangs out at the beach. So the Williams Pipeline was just a no-go, not to mention we cannot put any more money into fracked gas infrastructure. We need to really focus on renewable energies going forward. And so I have a petition for you to sign on my website, so please sign that. And there's also a petition to tell Congress to ban factory farms, but we already know that that has to happen and that it's not going to happen with this administration. So anyway, I would like to share with all of you my recipe from this week. I had so much Thanksgiving food and leftover Thanksgiving food that I just needed a quick meal that I could put together, since I was also a little tired of cooking and wanted something easy. So this is a sfoglini pasta. That's spelled S-F-O-G-L-I-N-I. It's a very interesting pasta. I'd never seen it before. It was an organic pasta at a little store that I was in. I bought it, and I cooked it up with some tofu, mushrooms, and broccoli. And it was quick, easy, and delicious. So I want to share that with you. So I had 1 pound of that pasta. You can, of course, use any pasta of your choice, but get a really nice artisanal one for this so that the flavor is really delicious. And if you need gluten-free, of course, go that way too. 1 block of extra firm tofu, and I cut this into slices that were 1/4 inch thick, and then each one of those slices I cut into 4. So that the pieces were little rectangles, a little thinner than when I usually cube it. This way, more flavor could get into the center. And then I just sautéed it in a cast iron pan with some garlic and got that really golden brown and just set that aside. And then I had an onion that I cut into slivers, 1 bunch of broccoli that I cut into bite-sized florets, olive oil, 1 pound of Bella baby mushrooms cut in half or quarters, 3 tablespoons garlic minced, 2 cups of cherry tomatoes that I sliced in half, 1/2 cup of Marsala wine, 1/4 cup of fresh Italian parsley, chopped, 1 teaspoon dried oregano and 1 teaspoon dried basil, 1 orange pepper cut into slivers, 1 cup cherry tomatoes, 1/2 cup white wine, salt and pepper to taste. And if you like it a little spicy, you can also add some red pepper flakes to this. And 1/4 cup of toasted pine nuts. So you cook the pasta according to directions. Cook it a little al dente, a little underdone, so that you can finish it off in the pan. I cooked up the tofu, like I said, and I removed that from the pan. And I wiped out the pan, and I reused the pan to saute the mushrooms. I wanted to saute the mushrooms separately so that I could really get them a little crispy and give them the flavor of the Marsala wine. So I sauteed the mushrooms in some olive oil with another tablespoon of fresh garlic until all the moisture had evaporated and they were crispy. And then I added the Marsala wine and cooked that until the wine was absorbed. Then I set the mushrooms aside. Meanwhile, I covered the bottom of a large wok with some olive oil. I added the onion and sauteed that until it was soft. Then I added the broccoli and another tablespoon of chopped garlic. Cooked that for about 5 minutes. Then I added the orange pepper, the cherry tomatoes, and the white wine, and cooked that for just a couple more minutes. Added the oregano, basil, and pine nuts. And then I added back in the cooked tofu and mushrooms. And then after a few minutes, I added the pasta back in and a little of the white wine and salt and pepper to taste, and that's it. At the very end, you're going to toss in some fresh chopped parsley. And if you're going to use the red pepper flakes, you can add that at that time as well. And serve it immediately, and it's delicious. You know, of course, a salad on the side really would round it out, and that would be perfect. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Mark Winnie. Mark is the author of a new book called Food Town USA, Seven Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. And Mark was the executive director of the Hartford Food System from 1979 to 2003, and that's a Connecticut nonprofit food organization. He's also the co-founder of numerous organizations, including the Community Food Security Coalition, the State of Connecticut Food Policy Council, and the City of Santa Fe Food Policy Council. He was a Kellogg Foundation Food and Society Fellow and a member of the U.S. delegation to the 2000 Rome Conference on Food Security. And as a writer on food issues, Mark's work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Nation, Sierra, Orion, and Yes, to name just a few. And he's the author of 4 books. And today we're going to talk about Food Town USA. Mark, are you with me?
I am. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me. It was such a pleasure back in 2018 when you were our keynote speaker at the Long Island Food Coalition, and I got to tour you around a little bit on Long Island, and it's a pleasure to have you back on my show.
Yeah, it was a great day. I really enjoyed my time there.
Great. So how do you find time to write another book? I can't even finish the one that I've started probably 10 years ago.
Well, it's an obsession, bordering on an addiction. You know, I decide I have to write. I guess it's just kind of the nature of being a writer. You know, you don't ever really take a vacation. It's like your head is always moving along with ideas, and you keep a notebook by you because you just have to write.
So that's great.
Otherwise, it would be too much like work, and I hate work.
Well, that's how cooking is for me. I never feel like I'm working. So, although the cleaning part's another story.
right.
But anyway, maybe you could just share with my listeners a little bit about your own personal journey, how you got interested in food systems and where your career started. I mean, you've devoted most of your adult career life, or all of it, to working with food systems. And maybe you can share some of that with my listeners first.
Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a long story, but I'll try to make it short. I mean, I've really been at this close to 50 years, I hate to say, but that's just the way it is. You noted that I was the director of the Hartford Food System in Hartford, Connecticut. That was for 25 years, and that was really one of the very first organizations to think about food in a sort of larger collective sense about this thing we call a food system. So we're talking about production, we're talking about consumption and distribution, and we're, in particular in our case, we were talking about how we can improve the quality and affordability of food in lower income communities, which Hartford was and remains, unfortunately. And I moved on from there to other endeavors, including some national work on national food policy, trying to engage with both the administration and Congress. This is going way back. But it brought me into sort of another area from my sort of hands-on work in Hartford, organizing projects to the point where I realized that public policy was something I had to pay more attention to, and that we all needed to pay more attention to in order to get the resources and the attention we need to really change the food system. But you know, my sort of geographic progression was westward, and I ended up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I am now, where I've continued to do work on food systems and do some, and of course, a lot of writing. And I maintain a connection with the Johns Hopkins University Center for a Livable Future in Baltimore. So I still have that connection on the East Coast. And through the Center for a Livable Future, I've been working on food policy councils, which has kind of been my passion now for a number of years. And we've been able to see a significant increase in food policy councils over the last 10 years, from a little over 100 in the U.S. to about 300 today, so threefold increase in just 10 years, which I think speaks to the urgency and the energy of people who want to see some real change take place in the way that our food is produced and consumed, and also the questions of equity and making sure that everybody has access to good food.
Mm-hmm. How are you finding getting policy through these days?
Oh, well, I assume you mean at the national level.
Yeah.
I don't spend a lot of time doing that now, and I know I certainly have nothing but the utmost respect for the people who are slogging it out in Washington these days to try to hold the line on things like, you know, efforts to cut the SNAP program and, you know, just the general lack of respect that is shown for sustainability, for health of the planet and people, a million cuts and slices that are being taking place under the Trump administration, which are detrimental to all of us. But
right.
I see
on the local level, you're seeing change.
Sorry,
on the local level, you're able to see change.
On the local level, I see a lot of opportunity, and I think that that's where people have turned their time and energy recently. And we have just seen so much progress taking place in cities and counties, and to some extent at a state level, trying to make some real changes in the way that our food system works. So that's where I have, you know, turned, because I feel that it's a really productive time and opportunity right now to get involved in making changes and working with city government and county government. They, you know, this has been a major change over the last few years, that you actually see a lot of interest from mayors and city council and county commissioners and others in our food system, such that they want to put, you know, change laws, and they want to appropriate funds, and they want to have plans to make things better.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, my job here on the Progressive Radio Network, I get to interview so many people doing really great things. There was one I interviewed, someone from doing farm to pharmacy. Basically getting prescriptions for food and coupons to go to a farmer's market to buy the food. Just really great. So you're seeing a lot of those kind of things, and double your bucks so that people can shop at farmer's markets and being able to use the SNAP program at farmer's markets. So all that.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen all kinds of progress around, the city and state. And in spite of the fact that we have somebody in the White House who just doesn't give a hoot about our food system, you know, we still have these federal programs like the ones that provide funding to double the value of SNAP purchases at, say, farmers markets. I mean, these programs that were created by Congress and funded in the Farm Bill still are operating, and they're still providing tens of millions of dollars every year. So that's there. But I think the fact that we have, at the local level, we see cities putting up money and thinking about more ways that they can use their existing dollars to purchase locally produced food and make that available, whether it's in their schools or in prisons or through farmers markets. So, you know, I think this is what I really found overall, particularly in my book, was that communities are paying attention not just to getting good food and great restaurants and dynamic farmers markets, but they're also making sure as much as they can that everybody participates in that. This isn't just some elite enterprise. It's something that's available to everyone.
Right. Absolutely. So let's talk about your new book. So how did you pick the seven cities that you profiled in the book?
Well, I set off with the premise that I wanted to find cities that were not considered, didn't have exciting food scenes, that they weren't really known as foodie cities. That, you know, the premise was that if I could find places that are sort of very much off the foodie radar, but they are in fact doing interesting things around food, then good food and taking responsibility for people, everybody in our food system, was in fact becoming the new normal. I wanted to really show that, demonstrate that, you know, good food was indeed now the new normal. So, with, you know, with all due respect to all the great work that's going on in the New York City metro area, I didn't want to go to Brooklyn, or I didn't want to go to Berkeley, California. I didn't want to go to Boulder, Colorado. I wanted to avoid some of those B cities, but instead I chose a place like Boise, Idaho, or Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, because, you know, there were places that had very specific challenges over the years, but food had become a more prominent part of their existence, both in terms of its value, economic value, its economic development value, in some cases what it meant to the quality of life in the community, how it was building community bonds and social capital. So, you know, I also wanted regional diversity. So I had everything from Portland, Maine to Sitka, Alaska, to Jacksonville, Florida, to Boise, Idaho, Alexandria, Louisiana, Bethlehem, and then Youngstown, Ohio. Often these were places, you know, I was looking for places that were, you know, damaged in some ways. You know, they'd had a tough history, and that, you know, there, a lot of harm had been done, either by industry just pulling out and leaving people abandoned, and then what was the role in some cases with food playing a big part in their economic revitalization? And I also, you know, frankly, I needed to be able to find ways to have access to people and organizations in all of these places. So I had to choose cities where I knew people to some extent. Not didn't happen in every case. But fortunately, I've been around in the food world long enough so that I have friends and a network of contacts. So I selected cities also partially based on who I knew and, you know, their willingness and their to step up and help me navigate my way through a city.
Mm-hmm. And so the seven cities, what would you say would be their most commonality? That they had an industry leave, or that they were really struggling in the downtown area with businesses pulling out or people have moved away.
You definitely had some economic hardship that preceded its revitalization. In some cases, that revitalization had not yet taken place. That was the case with, say, Youngstown, Ohio. I think one interesting way that I chose cities and one interesting common denominator among all the cities was what was not there. Go back 10 years in any of those places, you'd be hard-pressed to find a farmer's market. You'd be hard-pressed to find a farm-to-table restaurant or farm-to-school programs. You'd be hard-pressed to find any sort of consciousness around food, local food, healthy food, even affordable food.
Right.
So what was not there was a very prominent feature and something that united all of these places. And again, that was sort of leading into my argument that what we have here is good food as a new normal, a new part of a very exciting, city life, small city life, small town life, even, rural areas, that was, so that food was factoring into making these places somewhere you'd really want to go, even though you didn't know about it. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily know that there was something exciting food-wise in Boise, but in fact there is. And
Right. You
also at the same time would find a city that was very committed to taking care of its own people, everybody. Mm-hmm. So those are really my two sort of takeaways here was people, these were communities that were really stepping up to make sure that everybody was participating and had access to good, affordable food. And the other takeaway was that you had an exciting and emerging food scene with lots going on, lots of choices.
Mm-hmm. You talk about rural America. I mean, these where you went still were cities, even if they were small. But just a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times, there was this article about the supermarkets leaving small towns, small towns where
Right. They
produce a good portion of our food in the Midwest. And the small town can't support a grocery store, and so the grocery stores close up, move out, and people have to really travel distance to get to a grocery store. And, so these little towns are starting their own little food co-ops, little private grocery stores to try to bring some food in.
Yeah. I read that article, and I thought it was very good. But even though these might be, some cases they were small cities, but in some cases they were really part of a rural region. And I found co-ops, food co-ops, becoming a fairly common way of addressing the lack of good, affordable food, even, or small markets. I mean, it was supposed to be a combination of what might be considered community for-profit markets. Go to Portland, Maine, and you'll find the Rosemont grocery store. Six small, independent, all part of one chain, one independent chain, but, very much, contributing to the community in every way possible, from buying as much food as they possibly can from local farmers to making sure that every time they need an accountant or a plumber or a painter or anything, that they're always sourcing that service or product from a local business. To Sitka, Alaska, which has the highest food prices in the country, you cannot get to Sitka by road because there are none. You have to get there by plane or boat. Your food comes in from Seattle on a barge over an 800-mile, 3-day trip. So they have a great food co-op in Sitka, the Sitka Food Co-op. They're also in the process of trying to establish a food co-op in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. People were looking for, it's also a great food co-op in Boise, Idaho. People were trying to find solutions to the challenges that they faced. And oftentimes it was some degree of community, very strong community support and a commitment to community businesses, as well as, taking the food co-op approach to solving problems. And it was that kind of local energy of problem solving, which it was kind of a common denominator that I found very invigorating and inspiring, and lessons that I think would apply to any place in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And what about restaurants and food service places like that? Did you find the new food movement in restaurants that you came upon, sourcing local and, cooking sustainable food?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was every place I went had good restaurants, if not great restaurants. Everyone had at least one or two farm-to-table restaurants, even the smallest places. I mean, some places like Portland, Maine, are insanely local and tremendous food. I mean, Portland was probably the one city out of my seven that you would still have to say was very up, very high up on the foodie radar. It was very, people know it as having a great restaurant scene. But other places, one thing I think that's actually very interesting about the food scene that we don't quite recognize is how people move around. And, you know, somebody who starts out as a chef in New York City shows up with running their own restaurant in Sitka, Alaska, because they just happened to decide they wanted to move to Alaska. That's exactly mm-hmm. what I found. I found a chef in a restaurant in Sitka who had, it was one of the most amazing salmon meals I've ever had in my life. And I asked her where she learned her skills, and it was with Danny Myers in New York City. And I said, mm-hmm. Oh, wow, so you're 4,000 or 5,000 miles away, and, you know, you bring in your talents to this faraway place. And that's part of that. That's part of the story. It's like we're a bunch of bumblebees that are sort of moving around and pollinating plants further and further and going further and further out. And mm-hmm. So that was part of the fun, part of the discovery.
Right.
And even
right.
in a place like Boise, Idaho, there were 10 restaurants that had a legitimate claim to being farm-to-table restaurants. And the relationship between the chefs and the restaurateurs and the farmers in all these areas was significant, but particularly in Boise. I mean, it was a very strong bond between the farmers and the restaurateurs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so nice. And I know organizations like Slow Food, which I'm very involved in, really works to try to help build those connections. And it's just happening organically, not to use that word lightly, communities all over, right? Because it makes sense.
Exactly.
Once you start
right.
really
like
realizing
you
where
now.
Your food comes from, mm-hmm. how can you not, you know, want to support the farmer?
Everybody's paying attention, and they're not, and I would, it's beyond lip service. There's certainly a certain amount of greenwashing going on. I mean, I talked to some farmers who said, yeah, that restaurant claims that they're farm to table, but I know they're really not. But for the most part, there was a consensus out there that, you know, there is a commitment to sourcing locally. There's a commitment to paying, you know, a fair price to the farmer, even though, you know, the business side of this is still not fully resolved. I mean, there, you know, the cost that, you know, what a farmer can get from a restaurant is still, in many cases, doesn't bring them up to a, you know, a decent middle class mm-hmm. Standard. But at the same time, the restaurants are often doing the best they can. And, you know, there continues to be some struggle around some of those business-related issues. But mm-hmm. I would say that philosophically, commitment to buying local and to making sure your restaurant's identity is authentically local is growing. I mean, go beyond food. Look at the beverages. I mean, the number of places where you would have, craft beer, brewery, wineries, distilleries, cideries. It was phenomenal. One could stay drunk on local beverages for the rest of their life if they wanted to, or if they could live that long. But yeah, it's out there, and it's also, it's providing a new source of revenue for farmers. You know, I can sell my apples at the farmer's market and not make a whole lot of money, or I can turn it into cider and get, $15 for a pint of cider at the farmer's market. So the value added opportunities are expanding. So that's a lot of what I witnessed was just, you know, very smart farmers looking for those opportunities within that local marketplace.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a couple of minute break. And when we come back, I'd like to, hear about the access to all these wonderful food movement things to people of lower income, and whether it's, you know, if that issue is being dealt with. So, and everyone listening, don't go anywhere. My guest is Mark Nguyen from, actually from Santa Fe right now, but he is the author of a wonderful new book and called Foodtown USA, Seven Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. Be right back.
In 1995, Azeem Kamisa's son Tariq was shot and killed by a 14-year-old gang member on the streets of San Diego. Instead of seeking revenge, Kamisa sought out the family of the shooter.
And I reached out in forgiveness to his grandfather and guardian. What I told him is, what I see here is victims at both ends of the gun.
The two men collaborated to take the message of nonviolence and forgiveness into schools for thousands to hear. Hear about it on the next Peace Talks Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Nguyen. He is the author of Foodtown USA, Seven Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. And we were talking about the different cities that he chose and why he chose them and the food movement that is really changing their social economics and their the way business is being done, and it's really exciting. So, Mark, can you share with us, in your travels, did you find that these new economic opportunities were, I know some were going directly to the farmers, but for instance, could the farmers buy the value-added products? Could the farmers go afford to go to the restaurants that you were seeing?
Oh yes. Yes, certainly. The restaurants that I was looking at, I would not say they were high-end for the most part. I think in terms of their pricing, their, you know, menu pricing, I would say that it was, you know, in a more of a middle range. There were a few exceptions with some restaurants that were really going for the high end, but I think the norm is something where we're looking for affordability, good food at a fair price. And yes, the farmers were eating in the places that they were selling their food to, and that was certainly a nice feature. I also found that all seven cities had some kind of effort underway to make sure that lower income households were able to shop, say, at a farmer's market. That there were special double up buck coupon programs or other incentive based programs that were being funded. If not by federal grants, then in some cases they're actually being funded by hospitals or funded by even City Hall. In the case of Boise, Idaho, City Hall so the city government was actually putting up money for a double up bucks program with their farmers markets. So, you had food banks, and you had the efforts underway to just increase access as when needed as much as possible to food assistance programs, whether it was SNAP or WIC or school meal programs. In Sitka, Alaska, there was even a fisheries to school program, literally the fish traveled, I think it was about a half mile from the docks where the fishing boats came in, to the school.
Oh, I love
public
it.
Public school. And so it was, straight shot. The fishermen in that case were actually discounting the sale of their fish to the school. And another nonprofit organization was providing a little bit of funding support so that you had the sort of partnership right within this little community to make sure that everybody in that community was able to get this fantastic fish that was coming right out of the waters just down the street from them.
Right. Well, I'm in a school district right now that's on the water, but you wouldn't know it, Glen Cove, and they don't even have fish on the menu. The only fish that they would have had would be fish sticks, and kids didn't like that, so they took that off. So there's no fish on the menu at this school that I'm working in right now. I was just talking
about that. It's an interesting problem. I mean, in Sitka, Alaska, you have 500 commercial fishing boats licensed by the state of Alaska. And, 98%, maybe 99% of the catch, and this is the Gulf of Alaska is the largest fisheries in the U.S., the continental U.S., and 99% of that food is leaving Alaska, not just Sitka, but leaving Alaska. Most of it is going to Asian markets. So a lot of this catch is not coming into the people right there in the town or the state or even the United States. And I found one very interesting project called Sitka Salmon Shares, which is made up of 25 fishermen who own the company, not a co-op, but they are the shareholders. And they all of their catch goes into this shareholding program that where the fish is processed right in Sitka, and then it is in flash frozen and shipped to the Midwest. Now, in this case, again, the fish is leaving the community, but the fishermen are getting a much better price, and they also control the processing. They are both the producer and the middleman, and that the people buying the fish are about 6,000 shareholders in Illinois and Wisconsin. So, you see that kind of project emerging so that you're providing a better deal for the fishermen, but at the same time, you're also providing an opportunity for people in the Midwest to understand what is going on with the fisheries, what the threats are, and how they can help to support fishermen in the same way that many of us think about how we can support farmers. So,
movement of community-supported agriculture, there's also community-supported fisheries. And, that's really starting to take hold. 10 years ago, there was only a couple, and now you're really starting to see more and more farmers' markets having, farmers' markets, of course, selling fish, but, separate CSAs or CSFs where you can actually buy a share of, a local fish company and get what they provide. So,
right.
Pretty cool. So in your book, you talk about the individuals and, the power of the people and how individuals are kind of driving this movement. Which do you think the food policies on the local level are supporting that, or are they molding to what the people want, or are they driving the engine?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic, and I come out of it, being a nonprofit organization tradition, and working in groups and working with coalitions, and talking a lot about sort of the larger conditions within the food system that have an adverse effect on people and communities and the environment. But when you get right down, those are all factors, of course. But when you get right down to it on the ground, and you're trying to solve problems, you really find it's a relatively small number of individuals who are taking the bull by the horns and trying to make something happen. Sometimes they're starting nonprofit organizations, or they're coming up with really entrepreneurial ideas. Other times they are, full-blown for-profit business people who are starting a new business, a restaurant or a brew pub, or even this salmon share program that I described in Sitka. So everybody I talked to in one way or another had sort of two agendas. One was to, make sure they had either a successful business or a successful nonprofit organization and doing good work in both sides of that. But they also were very much embedded in the community, and they sought out and worked very closely with the rest of the community. These weren't just, the self-made person who up by the bootstraps or highly competitive entrepreneurs. These were people that saw their success is linked very closely to their communities. And in fact, helping each other. I mean, you would have 10 different brew pubs in Jacksonville, Florida. You go back 10 years and you had none, keep in mind. Now you have 10, and they all work together. I mean, you go into one brew pub and you'll find taps for, you know, several of the others around the city. You found the same thing with cafes and coffee roasters. I mean, people were, you know, sharing, you know, the opportunities to sell each other's products. They were providing mutual support for each other in terms of technical support. You know, I'm having a problem with this. How do I solve it? Another business would help them, try to help them figure out the problem. So a very interesting, and it's kind of exciting and mutually supportive form of capitalism that I think really is sort of the future. But I also think it speaks very well of food and the role that food plays in supporting economic, the role that it plays with economic development. And it just makes community life so much better. The quality of life, the quality of food, the fact that, I mean, everybody had their own the nonprofit organization that they were supporting, a charity that they were supporting. They were always doing fundraisers at their brew pubs or their coffee shops or their restaurants, the chefs. Everybody was like, it was a very supportive environment from, you know, the top of the business cycle to the, you know, the people who are economically and socially in need. So, that it's a model that I find very reassuring, because I think that it's something that we're seeing all over the country, and I think it's going to provide some real fundamental on the ground changes in our food system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see some of those same changes that you're talking about, because food not just brings people together, but it elevates everybody to kind of bring their best around the table, you know. And I have seen it, you know, in my work around food, and it has changed so many people. I was talking at the beginning of the show about the community event I do for Thanksgiving. And for 25 years now, I've been feeding, I've been partnering with the River Fund and feeding people who are really in need. You know, some of them are homeless, some of them, you know, live in the projects, but, you know, they all are needing enough that they'll wait online for hours for the food that is coming to them, not just the food I prepare, but also the mobile food pantry that we're partnering with. And we bring coats and everything. So it's a great, you know, day for them, and they are happy to wait online. And they get a lot out of it. But the people that come to my home for the 4 days before are thriving and are hungry for this sense of community, of working together.
Yeah.
Because in suburbia, where I live on Long Island, it happens very rarely. You know, there's some really standout communities where you'll feel community, and around a yoga center you'll have some community or a good health food store. But, you know, your small health food stores that used to attract that now have been replaced by Whole Foods, which doesn't have that same vibe. And so there's not that many places for people to come together to work on a project and just be a part of a greater whole. And
right.
I can't tell you how many people are upset that I'm not going to be doing Christmas this year, because look forward to coming. Their kids look forward to it. I mean, it's a memorable day in their kids' lives from one year to the next, when they come back to mash those potatoes or scrub potatoes in the bathtub or whatever project they end up doing.
I've yet to see anything as effective as food as a way to bring people together, no matter what the project or the purpose. It's, you know, and I'm not just talking about sitting down at the dining room table together to eat. I'm talking about all the things you're talking about, all the projects and ways of helping other people or ways of creating new businesses. It has a way of, I think, knocking down barriers, social, economic, and cultural, and, you know, finding, you know, a good space where we can all, you know, work together. So you know, I saw it many times over. I mean, just here's a kind of a symbiotic relationship in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where, you know, in the downtown area, which had been struggling ever since the Bethlehem steel mills closed in the 90s, knocked 30,000 people out of work, and they're trying to figure out what is Bethlehem going to become now that it's not a steel city. And a lot of small businesses were starting up in the downtown area, but, you know, there wasn't quite enough money to support all these little businesses. Out of those businesses, about 50 to 60 of them were small restaurants, ethnic restaurants, owned and operated by people who lived right there in those neighborhoods. So it had a very, very sort of multicultural feel. There were, you know, Puerto Rican restaurants, there were El Salvadorian, Peruvian restaurants, and so forth. And one thing that happened is that they decided that through their educational system that they were going to open up a charter school dedicated to the arts for the Lehigh Valley. And they opened this up, I think, 4 years ago now. And 600 students come there every day. And they have 90 performances every year in the evening. And their parents and friends are coming to watch their children perform. And they're eating out. So the kids are eating out in the community, and the families are eating out in the community, and that's providing enough additional income to support a lot of these restaurants. And just up the hill, if people know Bethlehem, you'll find Lehigh University, which had been, for a while, had a kind of a tense relationship with the city over sort of those typical town gown kind of issues. And slowly they began to let down their guard and allow students and faculty and others began to become more of a feature in the community. And they, too, started supporting these businesses. So it's a combination of people thinking about, how can we work together on a somewhat larger but community level and at the same time support each other, support our businesses. If we start businesses, we need those businesses. They create jobs. They pay taxes. But other institutions at the same time can provide a very supportive role. So, you know, that's just one of many ways that food brings people together and solves problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, you interviewed people from all across the country for this book. Is there a particular story or conversation that really stood out to you that you could share with us?
Well, I think one thing that this project did for me in the course of the journey is to sort of knock down all my stereotypes. You know, I had all my stereotypes in place about what these places were going to be like. You know, they're going to be politically conservative. They're going to be annoying, obnoxious. They're going to be backwards and a bunch of yahoos. Well, I was the one who was wrong. Everywhere I went, I found, you know, amazing people doing incredible things. But I think maybe the most striking one was in Boise, Idaho, where I expected that Idaho, it is one of the most conservative states in the country. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I think they called the election for Donald Trump, you know, before the polls were even open, not closed, but even open, because there's so many Republicans in Idaho. But you go to Boise, and it's this very progressive oasis in the middle of this, otherwise the sea of red. And I found, I interviewed the head of the Boise City Council, a woman named Elaine Clegg. So I'm expecting somebody who would probably be somewhat conservative. Well, she's turned out, you know, she rides her bike to work to the city hall every day. She brings her bike up the elevator and parks it in the office. And she has been, she's a woman in her 60s, and she has been working almost every day since, of course, across her adult life to make Boise a better place by first becoming an environmental activist and all on a volunteer basis. Eventually, she was elected to the city council. Then she became the president of the city council. And she's been using every tool available within city government to provide for more open space, more environmental concerns, making sure that neighborhoods weren't all going to become either gentrified or just purely residential, mixed commercial use that allowed for restaurants and brew pubs and coffee shops to open up. they have a very large immigrant community in Boise, and she's working with the different agencies to make sure that immigrant needs are met, including allowing them to be able to grow their own food from whatever country they're coming from. And they took over, had a one very large piece of land that was undeveloped within the city boundaries that had been a farm. She made sure it actually stayed a farm. It's now a nonprofit community farm. The land is owned by the city, but is now dedicated as both an area to produce food as well as to do education around agriculture, food and agriculture. So you see one person, very quietly moving up the ladder to a place of power where she could apply, good, sound, progressive principles, and knowing exactly what the boundaries were. How far in an otherwise conservative area could she push the boundaries in order to get something done? And you need to be very local and very native to understand how to do that, especially in a place like Idaho.
Mm-hmm. That's a great story. Great story. Wonderful. So how would you say your work in Hartford for 25 years, how that experience informed this book or the research that you've done?
Well, I ended up, I had started out working for this organization called the Hartford Food System. And this is in the late 1970s, and nobody was using the term food system in the 1970s. And probably didn't, even today, it's not necessarily utilized that much. But, simply having that concept in my head in Hartford, starting out, I think I was 29 years old, and realizing that, there is this thing called a food system. There are these dots of production, distribution, of retail, of health, environment, and waste, and soil, and everything else that constitutes a food system. And that slowly I got that. I mean, it took me a long time, not only to understand what that was, but to how to apply it, so that whatever we did in the city and in the region, we were thinking about what the impact of that one action would be on all the other components of the food system. So it was about connecting dots, and that was a great learning experience for me. I was so lucky to be in that place for 25 years and learn these things from the ground up very hands-on way. And I took that food system thinking with me as I did this research. I wanted to look at all these places as a system, not just as, a collection of individual projects or individuals who are going around doing their own thing. I wanted to see how they were connected and how they all thought about the bigger picture.
Right.
So, while I didn't necessarily see it perfectly everywhere, I certainly saw evidence of it everywhere.
That's great. Well, we are part of a much bigger picture, and we need to all work together.
Oh, absolutely.
And, I don't know if you heard me at the beginning, and if you happen to be in New York, I hope you'll join us. But next Wednesday, the Brooklyn Public Library and 350.org, Brooklyn chapter, are sponsoring the Green New Meal, which is the Food Climate Connection, and we're going to be talking about how our food choices impact the climate and about creating food systems that are based on solid, environmental, sustainable, economic principles that work for everybody and create community. So I just want to thank you so much for your work, Mark. It's wonderful. The book is great. Everybody, go get this book, Food Town USA. Of course, you can find it on Amazon, and it's available in most bookstores. Right, Mark?
It is, yeah. I would encourage people to go to the publisher, if you'd like, Island Press, islandpress.org. It's a nonprofit publisher.
And, oh, wonderful.
They are selling the book, and if you use my last name, Winnie, W-I-N-N-E, when you order the book, you get a 20% discount. So Winnie is the magic word and gets you 20% off, and you're buying it directly from the publisher. So
wonderful.
You can also
I'll share
go
that on my website if anyone didn't get that. And Mark, thank you so much. And everyone listening, thank you so much. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.